May 17th, that's what I thought, okay.
Because it was issued on May 13th. Anyway, it's May 17th, I'm appointing Representative Brown and myself as a subcommittee for the purposes of taking testimony. I'm going to open a, an informational meeting on Department of Administrative Services assessments and user fees, and we have Bill Fink with us. We were going to try to do this on Tuesday, but we ran out of time, so we're going to take Bill first today, and also because he is suffering a little bit, and we're going to work to see if we can get him out of here.
Thank you.
In a timely fashion, so he can go lay down somewhere. So, Bill, we wanted to, and I need you to make sure to state your name for the record, so we wanted to get a little more information on the user fees at Department of Administrative Services charges, as well as the assessments and that sort of thing. And so I know you've put together a short presentation based on the handouts that you gave to us from the other day, so go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Fink. I'm the acting deputy director of the Department of Administrative Services. I have the handout from last time, which I think you have in front of you there. On the top sheet should look something like this.
Okay. It looks exactly like that, as a matter of fact. It doesn't look something.
I'm off to an excellent start. This chart, I thought would be helpful to the committee to sort of lay out proportionally what the fees and assessments within the Department of Administrative Services look like, how they match up proportionally, and how they match up from 03-05 to the 05-07 proposed or governor's recommended budget. As you can see, far and away, the with respect to user fees, the Information Resources Management Division, that's IRMD, and the State Services Division represent the largest portion of fee revenue that is fee-for-service revenue that's collected by the department. I would point out that the State Services Division is now the combination of what was previously two divisions. It combines what formerly was risk management, and now within that group you have risk management, the fleet, state surplus, and state purchasing. So it looks fairly large because it's a combination of all of those divisions.
Bill, you mentioned four. You mentioned risk management, fleet, purchasing. What was the fourth?
And because it's again, state management, fleet, surplus, and purchasing.
Surplus. Now, what is surplus?
There are two surplus programs, Mr. Chair. There's the state surplus program, which is a primary means of disposal of state property that's gone beyond its useful life. And we have a facility out here off Cherry Street that basically the state surplus plus program sells, makes available to the public used or beyond its useful life state equipment for purchase. So we get a salvage value out of the equipment after it's exceeded its useful life for whatever purpose we bought it. And it's a wide variety of things. It ranges all the way from dump trucks to microphones. I mean, they have everything out there. In the same building is the federal surplus program, which works a little differently, and it's a program by which the state disposes of federal surplus property on behalf of the federal government, gives state agencies or other public agencies, actually not just state agencies, but public agencies kind of first dibs on surplus federal equipment. We sell that for them. They keep a cut of the proceeds from it.
What do you mean they keep a cut? You mean
the feds do. they get a negotiated portion of whatever the proceeds are from the surplus property, the federal surplus property that's sold.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Brown?
I would suppose that there's probably some used equipment that you can't even sell. I mean, what happens to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brown, actually they sell quite a lot of the equipment. Typically, they generally will not take equipment that's not saleable, that's absolutely broken and not useful. While they normally, I don't believe they normally test equipment when it comes to surplus, they do, you know, ask the whoever's sending the equipment to surplus whether it's in working condition or not. So they generally don't accept a lot of stuff that's just absolutely broken. And normally what they do, well, they will normally market surplus equipment on oftentimes through the eBay operation there, where they tend to get their highest salvage value out of equipment off eBay. And then for equipment that doesn't sell on eBay, they'll make it available to the public through a public, I've forgotten the days now, there are certain days of the week, certain hours that the public can come out and look at the things that they've set aside for public sale. So, generally speaking, they don't take things that don't work. As I was saying, the IRMD, or Information Resource Management Division, is the other major source of fee-for-service revenue in the department. And I thought I would take a couple minutes here to talk a little bit about IRMD, since it is not only a large source of fee revenue, but it's also a large source of assessment revenue, at least in the 05-07 biennium.
Bill, let me have you hold on for just a second. You're not going to have to repeat anything, but I just want to acknowledge the fact that Representative Rosenbaum is here now, so we are a quorum, so we're no longer a subcommittee. We are now the full committee. Thank you. Just have to do that for the record. Go ahead.
As I said, the IRMD fee-for-service revenue and assessment revenue, particularly the assessment revenue in 05-07, represent a sort of the largest single revenues in the department. So I thought I'd take just a second and talk about how those assessments and how those the fee-for-service rates actually get developed in IRMD, and talk briefly about what each of the assessments and each of the fees are, and the basis for the fee or assessment. In relationship to other DAS charges, in 03-05, IRMD represented about 45% of all DAS user fees and about 17% of all DAS assessments. So you can see it's a pretty large single source of revenue within the department. In the 05-07 governor's recommended budget, it represents about 39% of all the user fees and about 32% of the assessments. You can see the proportion of fees and assessments shifted somewhat there, and that shift is largely due to there are three new assessments in IRMD in the 05-07 budget. So the increase in assessments is largely due to the addition of those three new assessments. And the new assessments are, there's an assessment for cybersecurity, which I think last week when we were here, Don Fleming talked with you about. There's a new assessment for business continuity planning, which is a program that coordinates the activities and plans of all the major state agencies in the event of a disruption of service, mission-critical services for state government, that there's actually a plan to recover and resume operations as quickly as possible. So that's the business continuity planning, or referred to as the BCP assessment, covers the cost, the IRMD cost of that activity. And finally, there's the I should put my money in the jar right now, because Linus, which is the legislative bill tracking system. I'm not exactly sure what LINUS as an acronym stands for, but it's a legislative bill tracking system that allows all the state agencies to track the status of bills during the legislative session and to be able to communicate back and forth with one another regarding a particular bill. So you all don't have 20 different agencies over here testifying in every imaginable direction about the same bill. It allows the agencies to work together, coordinate their testimony so that make better use of the agency's time, make better use of your time during the legislative session. Those are the three new assessments. In addition to those, there are continuing assessments for enterprise policy and planning, which is the basic governance function of the state chief information officer's office. Don talked a little bit about that function last time. What that is that it's the part of the state chief information officer's office that develops the strategy, the implementation plans, the resource investment plans in conjunction with state agencies for enterprise activities, those things that touch most, if not all, of the state agency infrastructure. So, cybersecurity is an activity that is that's an enterprise activity. The planning and the resource investment and the actual implementation planning for cybersecurity is supported through the state CIO's office, and it pulls in all of the state agencies that are affected to work on this project. So the enterprise policy and planning function, or that assessment, supports that part of the state CIO's office that coordinates enterprise planning.
Yeah. And every agency pays that assessment as well?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, every agency pays that particular assessment. In the end, the work, enterprise planning work, ends up touching every agency in one way or another. The assessment for that is sort of a blended assessment that takes into account that the extent to which smaller agencies benefit or do not benefit from enterprise planning. The assessment is based for small agencies, which means agencies with fewer than 100 legislatively adopted FTE. For small agencies, there's a flat rate that they're charged, or flat fee that they're charged. If you're a small agency, you get charged the same fee. Larger agencies are charged, their assessment is allocated based on about 50% of the value of the assessment is allocated on agency FTE, and the other 50% of their allocation is allocated on their legislatively approved limitation. So it treats small agencies and large agencies differentially.
So large agencies, again, are charged 50% on FTE?
50% on FTE and 50% on limitation.
And when you say on FTE, is that based, what's the basis for that? Is that legislatively adopted FTE, census on a particular date, or...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for any of these rates or assessments that are based on FTE, it's the legislatively adopted FTE in December of odd numbered years. Yes, there are a lot of odd years, so it's odd numbered years. And what that amounts to is that we take the legislatively adopted FTE in the December before the price list of goods and services is published. So it's the most current reading we have of FTE before we have to publish the price list of goods and services.
So December of 05 is the next time
that's right.
And it's based on the legislatively adopted or approved number of FTE.
That's correct.
Okay. With regards to the 50% on limitation, how is that calculated? Limitation on computer stuff, or limitation on the entire budget?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's total limitation, and it's unlegislatively adopted as well, so through e-boards to the point in time that we actually put the assessment or the fee together.
If I have a budget limitation of $100 million, and I just picked 100 because I can do the math, and 50% of that, so I'm going to be charged a certain amount based on $50 million of my budget?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the 50% FTE, 50% limitation formula is a weighting formula. So 50% of your assessment is based on how large your limitation is. 50% of the value of that is based on your legislatively adopted FTE. So it's not, we don't take like 50% of what your limitation is. It's a weighting for the assessment itself. So if you have a large assessment, if you have a large limitation, agencies with larger limitations, smaller FTE, don't get punished just because they have a large limitation. So you get a balance between the two.
Okay, and is it X cents per thousand, X cents per million? How's that figured?
Mr. Chair, I'll check with you and get back on that one. I'm not exactly sure what the ratio or what the formula for that is, but I'll get back to you on it.
Because I'm trying to figure out if I have a, you know, I don't care whether it's a 1 million or 10 million or 100 million or like in the case of DAS, or excuse me, DHS, Department of Human Services, $10 billion budget, what's my cost for IRMD to the Department of Administrative Services going to be? Is it going to be, you know, I mean, that's a pretty large amount of money that, you know, I would like, if I'm the director of DHS, I would like to be seeing going to, well, and as a legislator, I'd like to see that money going to, you know, on-the-ground services, not to feed a bureaucracy here in Salem. So maybe you can help me understand.
I'll get that information back.
That would really be good to help me understand that a little better. Thank you.
Catch up with myself here. Other assessments are the e-government assessment, which supports the e-government platform and the working.gov. It's a flat fee for large agencies. It's sort of the reverse. It's a flat fee for large agencies. It's based on FTE for agencies with fewer than 100 FTE. Small agencies, again.
And again, the census is at the same time, that December of odd numbered years.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. If I could take a couple minutes here and just sort of describe the process by which rates and assessments are set. They have taken on this aura of the Rosetta Stone or something. And it really, you know, believe me, it's not that difficult. The most difficult part, actually, just as an aside, the most difficult part of it is not really building the rates and assessments. It's once they're built, taking a look at them and determining whether or not the way they're built hits agencies fairly. Because you can, as we all know, it's like you can be methodologically rigid and have a methodologically beautiful outcome that is incredibly unfair when it's applied. And so the hardest part becomes once you have the product, taking a look at it and saying, okay, How does this hit small agencies, you know, board and commission with like 3 employees, or DAS with 900, or DHS with 9,000? So that becomes more of the difficult part of the exercise. This is generally the way that these are set, and I say generally because we don't go back to the, I'm going to describe the bottom-up process of setting rates. We don't always, with every biennium, we don't go back to the bottom on every rate. The amount of time that would take is incredible. So what we tend to do is we will look at those rates that we have not visited in a biennium or two, or those where we know there is some circumstance in the environment that it would be reasonable to expect that rate should change, or the fairness of that rate is not as fair as it was the last time we worked it. So we'll work those rates again, and this is the process that we would follow. Begin by identifying the core programs. So take IRMD for example. We'd identify within IRMD for determining its rates and fees for service and its assessments. What we would do is we would determine what the core programs in IRMD are. And core programs are those programs that have a statutory basis for existing. Or if they have no statutory basis, they have a clear legislative direction for existing, and we identify what those programs are. We'll then take a look at those programs and say, given the expectation level that the legislature has and the governor has for the performance of this program, what is the resource threshold? What's the minimum level of resources that it will take to operate this program and meet those expectations? And that's resources in terms of the staff, equipment, professional services to support the activities, and so on. It's all of the cost attendant to it. And we'll actually go from the bottom up and build that budget for that program based on the core mission of the program. To that number, we will add policy option packages that will be part of the governor's recommended budget, part of the agency request budget, which is an important distinction to make. That total cost is then allocated using the allocation formula, whether it be on FTE, limitation, terabytes of storage, whatever the basis is, it's then allocated on that basis to the agencies. We look at how the allocation plan falls out, and we'll make some adjustments from time to time if we see that a charge is going to unfairly land on a small agency or unfairly land on a large agency. We'll make adjustments to try to accommodate the disparities in the rate structure. That's the information that is included in the price list of goods and services that y'all are looking at. Important to remember that what you see in the price list of goods and services is what it takes to run the core program, plus any improvements or enhancements to that program that the agency is proposing in the agency request process. So what you have is you have kind of, I guess, what you would call the largest the maximum possible number at that point. As you move through the process, of course, some of those policy option packages will fall out in the governor's analysis of the agency's request, and more will fall out or get changed in the legislature's consideration of those requests. So what you see in the price list really is like, this is like about as much as it could cost. In addition to the assessments, let me go back to the service charges. In addition to the assessments, DAS has, or IRMD has, 5 major service charges, and those are the service charges for the general government data center, which are primarily hosting applications for agencies and storage charges. Those charges are, believe, exclusively based on machine capacity. So it's the capacity of the machine that's used allocated across the users of the machine. The systems development and consulting fee, which is simply systems development and consulting provides, as it says, consulting services to agencies and to help them develop applications that they have been required to develop for one reason or another. And those charges are on a per-hour basis. It's just the cost of the personnel and overhead allocated per hour, and that's what the agency gets charged. If you have a systems development consultant come out to work with you on your project at DHS, and they're there for 100 hours to do that, it's 100 hours times the rate, which I think is $91 or something like that. So the other there's the data and video services fees, and those are the fees for transmission of data and video images, and those are based on the amount of bandwidth that the user requires. So these are, as you can see, as we go through these are user governed. The amount, in large part, your utilization will determine how much you're charged.
Okay.
And finally, the printing and distribution plant, which is the state printing plant, and those charges are on a per unit basis that is based just on the actual cost of producing the job. So again, it's a case of if I don't ever use the printing services of the print plant, I don't pay the print plant. But if I use it a lot, I pay them a lot. Those are the fees and services for the Information Resources and Management Division. The process that I described for developing the fees and service, the fees for service and the assessments for IRMD is essentially the process that we follow whenever we develop a fee for service or assessment in any division for any program of the department. Again, I'll go back just to double back on something I said. I think the last time I was here keep in mind that the factors that drive increases in our assessments and in our fees for service are the same factors that drive the increases in budgets of any state agency. We have inflationary increases on SNS, all the base budget adjustments, debt service, which is probably a factor that affects GAS more than other agencies. We carry a lot of debt service because the services that we provide to other state agencies occasionally are debt financed, and so we carry all the debt service on it. And then there are the policy option packages, which are generated by the agency and may or may not be accepted by the governor or the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
So, oftentimes I will say that I have an opportunity to talk with some of my colleagues in state agencies, I'll be perfectly candid with you. You know, the DAS charges are generally not well understood. And I think that it's largely because there's this huge mystery that's grown up around them. They're pretty straightforward, what drives them is not as one manager in an agency said to me once. Well, you know, the difference between you guys and us is that you get to just add whatever you want into your budget and just charge us for it. And we don't get to do that. I told them, we don't get to add whatever we want. And so largely our budget is driven by the very same factors. And I think in the RO507 budget, although I haven't done an analysis of this, but I would say that probably in RO507 it's driven more by the same factors as every other agency and less by policy option packages than it has been in the past.
I think that's an important factor because you're right. There are some directors out there that I don't think they do understand what their Department of Administrative Services charges are based on, how they're figured out. And that's sort of why we're here, is to kind of start trying to figure some of that out. And there's a lot of folks, a lot of us in the legislature that don't know that basis either. And there is, whether it's an accurate perception or not, there is a perception out there that if DAS needs more money, you just charge the agencies more, and there you are. That you can just sort of add to your budget at will. And that's also one of the reasons why I was asking the questions previously. Haven't asked it today yet, but why I was asking the questions previously in terms of whether the directors really know what they're being charged for, what the difference between the user fees are and the assessments, and why it is that and when it is that you actually make the charges, and are there times when you charge, when you get to the middle of a biennium and you turn around and raise your fees. Whether they can use their fees or the assessments.
Mr. Chair, I would have to say, and I think that we're highly sensitized to that. Our current administration is highly sensitized to the fact that we just need to do a better job of educating our own customers about what they're paying for and how those fees and assessments are built. I think that if we do that, I think that people will have a better understanding. It won't be such a mystery to them. I can't say that folks will be happy that they are paying DAS for their computer charges when, in their view of their mission, they could be spending that money on something that they see as more directly related to their mission. But I don't use any excuse to not make every effort to make sure that they understand what they're paying for and how those prices are built. And we're making a much more aggressive effort at that these days.
I'm glad to hear that. The other thing that I think is a perception out there in our agencies, because of the very nature of DAS, from the standpoint that you're. I've referred to it before, and I know that the director doesn't appreciate this, and I probably wouldn't either if I was the director, but sort of as a two-headed monster, the one side being, the governor's goons that go out and make the agencies toe the mark and behave themselves and that sort of thing, and on the other side, providing services, and the agencies are your customers. And the one problem that you sort of run into with that is that on the customer side, the agencies have a fear that if they complain about the charges or the service or any number of other things, that the other head of the monster is going to come over and, rip into them or retaliate. And so that causes, for me, some concern because from a customer service standpoint, you want your customers to be happy, or at least I hope you do. If you don't, we need to change your business model. But you want your customers to be happy. But on the other side, there's that side that you're not concerned about whether they're happy or not. You're concerned about whether they're following the law or whether they're doing things the way they're supposed to, either as prescribed by us or prescribed by you in rule. And I think that's so that does create somewhat of an interesting dichotomy, I think, within the other agencies. Questions for Mr. Fink? No, not at this point. Bill, I appreciate you coming and giving us this overview. It definitely gives me a better understanding from the standpoint of the Information Resource Management Division. And I'm going to assume that the other agencies the other divisions are pretty much the same. You sort of used the big guy to demonstrate it for us. I do have one question though on your on this guy, and that is that the user fees in both, you know, there are five areas that, that are based on user fees, but those same five areas are also included in the assessments. So what's to keep me from being, you know, as a state, if I were a state agency director, what's to keep me from feeling like or getting the impression that I'm being double billed for the same services? I mean, if I'm paying, you know, fees to the state controller's office, why am I also paying a central government charge, you know, to the state controller's office?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in fact, you put your finger on, I think, one of the sort of the largest points of misunderstanding or confusion, and that is that in fact, some divisions, it appears that you're paying a fee to use their services and an assessment to support them at the same time. And there are, I guess I'd answer that in, well, we'll answer it in one way, DAS, in most of its divisions, provide what we would call core business infrastructure for the state, and that is, those are services, and they are buildings and wires and computers and things that that everyone in the state every agency in the state benefits from. Some of those things we can actually allocate those costs in such a way that, in fact, we can tell you if you use one, you know, bit of this, it's going to cost you this much money. There are other things, and examples of that are things like data transmission services and applications hosting at the general government data center. Where we can tell you it's like you use this much of, use this unit of service, is going to cost you this much money. So use 20 of these, it's pretty easy, 20 times this much. There are other things that are much more difficult, that support the infrastructure of government, that are much more difficult to break into utilization units like that. An example of that would be the DAS director's office, for example. You as an agency director may talk with the DAS director two or three times a month about sort of touching bases, routine business, and that may be it for you for a year, and then you may have like a serious problem where you have to talk to the DAS director about how, you know, what kind of help can the DAS director give you to help you solve your problem. And sometimes that the DAS director will allocate DAS resources to help the agency do that or whatever. The point here is that the DAS director's office needs to be there. It's like if people were billed on a unit of service and they decided, well, I can control my costs by just not talking to the DAS director, then you would have no DAS director's office, and when someone needed it, which are more typically small agencies, when someone needed it, there would be no DAS director there. Mm-hmm. So everybody gets to pay for the DAS director on the assumption that it's a piece of the infrastructure that needs to be there when people need it. Same thing in the state controller's office. There are functions in the state controller's office that everybody needs. Federal reporting. We rely fairly heavily on federal funds in the state budget to say that what we're going to do is we're going to charge you for federal reporting based on the number of times or the number of pieces of paper that you have to submit to the state controller's office for federal reporting purposes. Would not provide the consistent support that we have to have there to be able to file reports to the federal government, negotiate with the federal government around federal funds issues on an ongoing basis. So, consequently, you may get a charge on a per-transaction basis for the number of payroll checks the state controller does for you and get an assessment charge for those core infrastructure functions that have to be there to interact with the federal government on, you know, whether it takes 90 hours this week and 10 hours next week, they have to be there. So, but we need to, I agree with you, Mr. Chair, we need to do a better job of explaining to our customers you know, why they're paying, what they're paying, and what they get for what they pay. What's the value in what you get?
My point exactly. I think that, you know, because I was going to bring up a question. If I'm getting an assessment, you know, I'm go back to being an agency head for a second, and I'm getting an assessment from Department of Administrative Services of, you know, $1,000 a month. Do I know what that $1,000 a month is covering? That's covering, you know, an assessment that's $250 in the state controller's office, $250 in the state, in the director's office, you know, whatever else. So now I know what that's covering. Now I know that any services that I use beyond these core things. So when I contract with the state controller's office to cut my checks for me, I know that that's going to be on a per transaction basis, and that is separate and away from what I'm, you know, from what I'm paying for on the assessment. It's, you know, it's kind of like my phone service at my house. I mean, I pay the phone company X number of dollars a month, and this is what's included, and I get, you know, some frills thrown in there, you know, call waiting and, you know, all of the voicemail and all, well, actually voicemail's extra. So I get some extra things kind of thrown in there. Now, if I want extra service, long distance service, it's on a permanent basis, or if I want, you know, the voicemail service or something else, now that's an add-on charge that's over here in addition to my base fee. So, you know.
And you know how much you're paying for each of them.
Right, exactly. Right. And I can see on my statement, you know, how much it is. Do I get that kind of an accounting, that kind of a statement from DAS?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you in most cases, you don't get that detailed of an accounting.
Okay. Mr. Chair, one thing that you failed to mention in that process is when you pay your phone bill, you don't get any insurance. The risk management is a large chunk of what DAS is providing for this overall assessment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And risk management, the costs, as you know, of insurance, the cost of protecting yourself, and this isn't just the basic insurance. This is significant insurance. The cost of that insurance continues to go up, and so.
But see, state services are both in a user fee and an assessment,
right.
and included in state services is that risk management.
Right.
So that's my point. So do I know when I'm paying for my state services,
how much I'm
paying based on that core function that risk management probably falls under, and that's the assessment side versus the services side. Every time I go rent a car, that sort of thing, and that's what I'm driving at is trying to figure that out.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you will know that at that level of detail. It's like you'll know from your bill whether you're paying for risk insurance or whether you're renting a car.
Right.
But probably not the level of detail that you're talking about with your home phone bill or whatever.
Yeah. Right. Now I do notice also, for example, that the state director's the director's office is not on the user fee side at all. But that's totally funded.
It's totally funded by
the assessment side, and that's a core function that I think everybody can understand. That. Bill, thank you very. Are there any other questions for Bill or comments? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chang.
Sure. Members,
thank you very much. I appreciate it. Okay, members. I'm going to close the informational hearing on the assessments and user fees from Department of Administrative Services. I'm going to open a review of the DEQ draft. You all have this in front of you. It's the latest, greatest model. I took the comments, I hope you've had a chance to review this, I took the comments that were made in committee and tried to incorporate them into both the body but also going back into the recommendations. So, and I split out the recommendations a little bit differently than the way I had them. I think that was the way they were stated before was probably a little bit confusing. So the first recommendation would be basically to have that the DEQ contract with an unbiased third party not previously associated with DEQ that would review the Adams report and a DEQ response for accuracy and validity. Further, we would be recommending the department report back to this committee if the task is accomplished before the end of session, and or to the Joint Legislative Audits Committee if session has ended.
Mr. Chair, I think that impartial review is very important.
Thank you. Okay. Are there any other comments about that recommendation? Is there any angst over that? Okay. The second recommendation would be that the if the Adams report is...
It should be B, I think.
Should the Adams report is found to be valid? Pardon?
I think should the Adams report be found to be valid? Or if it is...
Oh, you're right.
And you're going to have to have an if in there to use is.
And Andy tried to correct me on that, and I missed it.
No.
Should the Adams report be found to be valid, the department would move to an audit of its calibration systems. This is kind of talking, getting a little more detailed what you were referring to the other day, Representative Butler. Systems and future installs for any equipment needing calibration to be certain of accuracy. The equipment should test for accuracy at the 0.05 level of confidence. This is pertinent to the enhanced test only as long as it is still in service. The standard is pertinent to the basic test as well.
I'm wondering if that audit should be an independent review as opposed to an audit. I think that was a problem that Representative Rosenbaum had.
Oh, okay.
So just change that to an independent review or a review. And certainly it could be an independent review, but they could do that internally as well. It's my understanding that the equipment probably has some warranty with it, that would be a review, but that wouldn't be an independent review. So,
right.
So a review as opposed to an audit.
I have no problem taking the term audit out of there and putting in independent review, but I think it should be an independent review because I think that's one of the things that we're driving at here with number mm-hmm. one and the mm-hmm. issues that Dr. Adams brought up is, you know, yeah, let's have a third party look at this.
Mr. Chair, your recommendation as to number two is appropriate.
Okay. So I'll change audit to independent review and change the is to a B.
Right.
Is there anything else in that that either of you can
see? Works okay for me.
Okay. The third one, the department is considering both the self-service, and I want to make sure that we recognize are recognizing this both for the self-service basic test and then for the online system. And we recommend that the Ways and Means Committee instruct the department to accelerate the development of such a system using the onboard diagnostic systems already installed on vehicles. And then as part of this type of system, the department should work to develop software to give those going through online testing immediate feedback as to pass-fail. And then additionally, this should be started as a pilot project with participants paying a reduced fee for using this system.
I think that's appropriate where those onboard systems really should be, and this provides the consumer a better access to even than their own garage.
Right. Are there any angst over that, or is that that's okay the way it is? Four, with the elimination of the enhanced test and with a considerable ending fund balance, the department should consider the restructuring, and that was a suggestion that Andy had made, Andy Ginsberg, should consider the restructuring of fees in both Portland and Medford so the fees are closely matched between the two venues. Fees should be at a level to allow the department to maintain a reasonable reserve fund. Is there any...
I think, Mr. Chair, particularly where they've been dipping into their reserves at this particular point, we need to be very cautious about that.
I would agree, and that's all. But that's also why, I mean, you all know how I feel about reserve funds. I think they're extremely important, that every department should have one. But I also want it to be reasonable.
Right.
And, you know, when it gets to be 20 and 30 and 50%, I think that's a little excessive. Then with the, so everybody's okay with that? With that one?
Mm-hmm.
Then with the number five is the Audit Committee recommends the House Committee on Environment study the exemption of vehicles over 20 years old from the VIP. And we're passing this off to the House Committee on Environment. And the effects this would have on, would have with maintaining the EPA standards for attainment of standards in the Portland-Medford areas. And since this group of vehicles is a minor part of the overall fleet, is sort of the reasoning there. And then also, the committee should also study the effects of expanding the exemption of newer vehicles up to 8 years. Is there any...
Mr. Chair, just the comment that Mr. Ginsburg made was that, you know, that I reflected again and again on that comment relative to the fact that this was how they were finding cars that could receive warranty work. I really don't think the state is in a position where we need to be identifying for private citizens the vehicles that should be taken back in for warranty work. The failure rate of these systems is about 0.01% with the refining that's done. So for the state to expend resources to be examining systems so that folks can go back in and get warranty work done, I think is not a valid reason for us to continue to try and access automobiles that are fairly new from the factory floor. So I'm concerned about any attempts to have the state intervening on behalf of these newer vehicles, and that we'd ought to go ahead. And again, the EPA standards are maintained on these cars, particularly those onboard systems. Every time they're in for service, they get the onboard system examined. I think that we have had in our family two or three automobiles that were so sensitive that just tiny modifications made that whole onboard system show an error and would force you into the dealer's showroom.
So sure.
They are very sensitive, and I think that that's appropriate that we start looking at newer vehicles up to the 8-year life that should be considered for exemption as technology moves out better and better.
Well, I think that's the thing that we're trying to recognize here. But at the same time, you know, I don't think this committee is necessarily in a position to be saying, you know, that we should that we should be doing that. So, you know, that this committee should be doing it. But and that's why I'm suggesting we hand it off to the Environment Committee to take a look at. And that's certainly something that they can be doing during the interim. Is there any angst over that, or is that that recommendation?
I think the Environment Committee is the place for it, and I think the recommendation to expand, to continue to examine the effects of expanding the exemption for these newer vehicles is an appropriate way to save folks in the state of Oregon money.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dingfelder.
Thank you. I know I apologize. I had a bill up in committee this morning, so I apologize for not being here at the beginning of this discussion. But however, since I was the one who had brought up objections to what was before number 4 and 5, I just wanted to comment. I'm okay with the way number 5 is written. However, again, I think the emphasis should be on maintaining EPA standards for attainment. I mean, again, there's a cost benefit to making sure that we're meeting our attainment standards and we're not passing on. I think there was a discussion about the fact that we basically, it's like thinking of a bubble, and if we raise the standards, or I should say lower the standards and raise the amount of pollutants that are coming out of mobile sources, and my understanding is then we have to look at lowering for industrial sources. So I guess the important thing is to make sure that we maintain that balance, and I don't know if there's somebody...
Well, Margaret is here, but that's one of the reasons why I'm suggesting that the Environment Committee, you know, take all of that kind of stuff into consideration and let them be the ones that, you know, are sort of making that call.
So that was my only concern, is making sure we're not, you know, sacrificing increases in industrial development by rolling back some of the mobile source controls, and I think that's the balance there that we have to keep in mind.
Well, I think that's I appreciate that. Hopefully the way this is worded, it is that it's broad enough that the Environment Committee doesn't feel like we're trying to pigeonhole them or force them into any particular direction, but just taking a look at those issues.
Mr. Chair, does Washington have a similar test that's being conducted on their vehicles?
Margaret, does Washington have? I need you to come up though, because then the mics won't pick you up otherwise.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Margaret Oliphant from DEQ Air Quality, and they do have do similar vehicle inspection testing as we do.
Okay, is it only in the Seattle area? Or?
It's in Seattle and Vancouver and Spokane.
Okay.
So I guess what we're finding out then is that across the river in Washington and Vancouver, they do have some kind of an air study going on there, and it might be good for the House Committee on Environment to just examine what they're doing across the river.
Sure.
Because if they're exempting cars already that are 8 and 10 years old that have the onboard diagnostic systems, then we may be more aggressive in the way we're pursuing. So, Mr. Chair, I think with the comments that our good representative Binkfelder has made relative to the concerns over vehicles 20 years of old age and the overall airshed in relationship to attracting industry, I think that it's appropriate.
Okay. And then number six. So we're all okay with number five there. Number six then is with advances in technology suggesting vehicles being a declining contributor, recommending that the House Committee on Environment study reducing the percentage of the plan currently devoted to vehicle emissions as the department negotiates with U.S. EPA. Starting in 2006, with an overall goal of sunsetting the program in 2026.
Mr. Chair, again, where you've involved the House Committee on Environment, those folks can take a look at the more technical aspects of it and see if they're headed in the right direction. It's my opinion that certainly just because we used to have people that would come around and clean up after horses doesn't mean we have to have them still today.
Right.
And that's what we're doing here is we're trying to bring this to the current day. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would make a motion that your letter of May 17, 2005, with the Scrivener changes that we noted, Mr. Chair, that have been noted on your copy, be approved for submission to the necessary parties.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Binkfelder.
I just have one comment on Section 6 that I forgot to mention before. And, I'm not going to... I mean, my suggestion would be just to leave out the last sentence. My concern about that is it's a predetermined, to me it sounds like a predetermined outcome in that, and I'll wait until the second page.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I've got a bill up in another committee also that I'm trying to...
No, I know how that is, having just done that. But my concern about the last sentence, when I read this, to me it sounded like a predetermined outcome. In other words, we're saying to the House Environment Committee, go ahead and look at this as an option because we know that newer cars are cleaner, although if I recall right, the graph, and I don't remember if Andy had provided or I've seen it somewhere else, is because we're actually, although cars are burning cleaner, we're actually... driving more miles every mm-hmm. year. So we're not making any gains. We're sort of saying static because although we're burning cleaner, we're driving more. And so I guess I have a concern about having a predetermined outcome because we don't know what's going to be the best. I mean, it could be that we want to sunset the program in 10 years. I'm just saying.
So if you drop the words in 2026, that would satisfy your...
Well, just the last sentence. I mean, I think it should be up to... it says that...
I think if we don't plant the idea, Representative Dingfelder, nobody's going to catch it. And my concern is that the overall goal would be to sunset the program sometime.
Yeah, say when it's determined to be no longer needed or something,
just
I guess.
Just period after the program at that point, yeah. Rather than in 2026. Because as you say, it might be in 2016, and by then these issues... The innovations in gasoline will have changed from leaded to unleaded, have significantly
and
changed the whole.
If we adopt biofuels, then that's another plus.
And that's another
plus. That form of motion, I'll second. We'll pass it right
plus
here.
There are, I would also throw in here that I can tell you with some certainty that GM, particularly in their SUV models, is looking at alternative fuels such as hydrogen.
Yeah.
They now have the Hummer It's the Hummer H2H, and it is fueled by hydrogen.
Well, and the president came out yesterday supporting biofuels, which is very optimistic. But so that was my only concern, that it sounds like a predetermined outcome, and then say the overall goal would be to evaluate, you know, the effectiveness or continued, you know, is this program needed in the future? And so I guess I would leave a little more open-ended.
And Mr. Chair, I think that there is a motion on the floor, and the motion would be to accept it, but I would modify the motion that we also just drop the words in 2026. That way the overall goal is still there.
Okay.
That is, at some point that we sunset this, I mean, by the time we get biofuels and H2H fuels and those kinds of things, the need for the program will diminish and go away.
And I would tend to agree with that.
Well, the question I have for DEQ is, do you have any goals in house? I mean, in your discussions with EPA, because it's based on what EPA says, you have to meet these goals, and this is one way we've decided to meet it. Has there been discussions about, with the decline in emission concerns, if at some point this may not be necessary? Or, you know, the only concern I have still, sort of, you know, in the back of my head, is that if we're increasing the miles that we travel, then do we still need this program because, we're still concerned about increasing emissions?
Chair Kremel, Representative Dingfelder, we're always looking ahead, but it's very difficult to assess the cars of the future and gasolines of the future and things like that. So we haven't set any kind of date that we would sunset this program, but we do evaluate it ongoing.
I would submit that I think that Representative Butler is absolutely correct. If we don't sort of plant the seed of a sunset, it will never happen. I'm fine with taking the reference to the time frame out.
2026, and that's
but I think that an overall goal, because again, look at where we are with just in the last 5 years of development of the hybrid cars. You know, five or 6 years ago when Honda came out with that funny looking little car, the Insight, everybody was sort of laughing about it, and now Toyota has jumped on it, as have other companies, and so I think that's leading to a reduction as well.
Open question.
The question's been called for. Is there? So the motion is to, I'll make the Scrivener's changes that have been suggested, and that we would submit this to the letter to the folks that have been noted: Joint Ways and Means, Budget Committees, Environment Committee, Senate Land Use, and the Speaker of the House, and then ourselves and the Senate President. Is there any objections? Do you want an actual roll call vote?
Or necessary by me.
I don't see any objections. So,
Representative Rosenbaum is there.
And she's excused. Okay? So, with that, thank you very much, members. And with that, I will close the DEQ informational hearing. And we don't have anything else that we're
So I missed the DAS part.
You missed the DAS part.
That was the most